What is up, business owners, entrepreneurs, and probably my grandma? You are listening to Business Vibe. Today's business interview is with Sebastian Knight, owner of OneTake.ai, a software company that does $1.1 million in revenue per year. Sebastian gives us the complete look at how he saved years by validating OneTake before he built it, the multiple ways he markets his business, and how he reduces churn. If you enjoyed this interview, please hit that subscribe button. There are many, many more to come. Enjoy.
Awesome, dude. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining me. How's it going? How are you doing?
Doing great. The day that we're doing this call is 2 days before we release version 6 of our AI model, OneTake 6. So it's quite a busy week, but it's fun times because we are actually this week we're releasing something that people have been asking for a long time. And that was completely impossible like 2 years ago when we started the company. And so I'm pretty happy with it.
That's exciting news. Good to hear. Yeah, you said it was a busy week. So I want to make sure not take too much of your time.
Don't worry. It's the magic of my role in the company is I work on product mostly. And by product, I mean like setting the vision, what the software should be doing, and talking to customers and setting that course. So the week that we deliver usually is the week where it's the engineering team that is like scrambling to get things done in time. And then I'm back when it comes to like QA testing time to validate that this matches what we wanted. So actually it's a busy week at the company level, but today was the perfect time to do the interview together.
Sounds like you got a great team in place.
I do. It was quite an adventure because maybe we can talk a little bit about how this company came to exist. We had the start that's probably a bit different from most startups. A lot of the startup founders that I've spoken with, they started either on their own or as a business person with one technical co-founder and having to be a jack of all trades. Startup OneTake AI is actually a spin-off of my previous business. So for the last 15 years, I've run the Free Entrepreneurs Movement, which is a coaching and training company. And we've helped 300,000 entrepreneurs in 41 countries to start and grow their businesses. And over the last few years, what became more and more visible is that the biggest challenge that a lot of small businesses have to growing their business is publishing content, specifically video content, to promote their products and services, to get themselves known on social media, to make the sale with webinars and sales videos. And also many of them also have like information products like online courses, masterclasses. And year after year, when we were doing surveys and speaking to customers, like the technical aspect of that, the hurdle of getting the video from the idea to being online and being a professional presentation was one of the main difficulties that people were facing. So that's why we spun off this idea to create a software that would do the whole work on the video for them. So that as an expert, a coach, you can just come and record yourself speaking fluently, normally, with all the mistakes and the blunders and all of that, and have the AI fix everything, fix the background noise, remove the awkward silences, and give you a polished, finished presentation.
Preparing for this interview, I was looking a lot into OneTake.ai, and I mean it's a great software. I'm seriously not just blowing smoke. And so when you said that it was inspired from an old endeavor, what made you ask the questions? Hey, is this what people need?
When I was growing that business, so the Free Entrepreneur Movement, the previous business, we grew that to a bit over 7 figures. So doing $1 million a year, had a team of 20 people there, and when COVID happened, we shifted to focusing first on serving our audience. So many of those entrepreneurs that we were helping, their businesses were in crisis. So we created a ton of free resources, lots of additional support, and supporting them through the crisis was the right thing to do, but at the same time was extremely taxing. And I felt like, okay, maybe there's a way that we can solve some of the problems they have, but without creating more new courses, but by giving people a solution that like takes away the pain instead of trying to alleviate the pain. So that's where the idea went. And then the idea of doing this as a software, we went through a process which comes from a book. So there's a principle that many people have heard of, which is called the Blue Ocean Strategy. And I read that like 15 years ago or more when it came out. And It's a book that inspires you, makes you think, wow, we should definitely have a Blue Ocean idea. But the original book has no way for you to do it. It just tells stories of people who have done it, and it's inspired, but it's not a method. What happened is maybe 5 years ago, the authors came back with a second book. I don't know the English title of the second book. It's also Blue Ocean something something. And the second book is a framework. So we went through the framework, figuring out like, if we wanted to create something new that would be completely different from what's available in the market, what would that be? And that's how came the idea of doing the software and doing not traditional video editing software, but something that has never been done before.
And so you said you talked, you know, to people and you saw that they needed this. How did you validate this idea and go, okay, this is definitely 100% something that the market could use and need, instead of, you know, we hear people spending years and years of their lives growing and building things that end up, you know, the market doesn't quite need. How did you guys validate that?
You're going to love this, because we were going to spend years and years and $250,000 before even building the product. And luckily, to give some context, had the idea, decided to do the video thing as a software. Luckily, one of my good friends is a video expert. He's a neuroscience expert, and he had created this format of video editing that uses neuroscience. But back then, you had to do it yourself. It was extremely costly and time-taking. And I said, well, we're going to take your method and build that into the software. And we had budgeted that just to build a proof of concept would take a year and $250,000 to €500,000. So we wanted to raise funds for this. And I went to a mastermind group that I'm a member of, led by American bestselling author Jeff Walker. And I said, this is the plan. Here's what we want to build. Here's the time it's going to take. And what came back from this mastermind session is people said, well, we're pretty sure that you should be trying to build a minimum viable product first that doesn't require like hundreds of thousands of dollars. It doesn't require a year to build. And so my partner was completely devastated. Like, he was like, what he took out of this session is people told us that our plan is terrible and we should just like go cry in a corner. And I said, but no, actually, this is a huge opportunity. Let's try to use this. So we spent the whole night after the session, outlining, if we're not building like a car, we're not trying to build a Tesla. We're just trying to build a mode of transportation, and we want to create this minimum viable thing. So we want you to do like a skateboard. What would that be? And basically, with a budget of $4,000, in 2 weeks, we had built the proof of concept for the software. It wasn't polished. It wasn't multi-users. There was no AI in it, but you could like manually get the work done with that. And that saved us so much time, because then we were able to like get some feedback. And the next step is, after building this proof of concept, I came back to my group of entrepreneur friends and I said, look, this old process of video editing that took typically 12 hours to do like 1 hour of polished presentation, now it's taking 45 minutes. And one of my friends there said, well, this is great, good news, but, and I knew to brace for the impact. And he said, well, I love that you went from 12 hours to 45 minutes, but 45 minutes is still like work. And I don't want to do the work. What I want is to just upload the video, click one button, and to get the thing to just work. So that's when we decided to build the AI components into this that came out in early 2022, so half a year before ChatGPT.
Like, looking back now, like you've already been doing this for several years, how much different do you think that would have been if you wouldn't have built an MVP, if you would have just spent all that money and put all that time into it? Would it have looked a lot different, probably?
It would have failed completely for two reasons. Reason number one is I've learned over the last few years that the fundraising part of the business is not something that I'm excited about. I'm good at marketing. I'm great at it. I teach it, but I hate sales and fundraising sales. It's add 1,000 angel investors to your LinkedIn, reach out to everybody individually, do 1,000 follow-ups with everybody individually. You have tools now to automate that, but it's like you're not trying to help the market by putting out something awesome and saying who's interested, which is marketing. When you're doing the fundraising, you're trying to get other people to buy into the company. And that was much less interesting to me. So I think if I had started with a year of that before even having customers, I would have hated it so much. I would just I've stopped probably.
So the importance of an MVP then, right?
Yeah, because when we had the proof of concept, we sold it. Like, we got the first customer and we said, you're going to be able to log in 3 months from now. And so by the time the software was first available, 1st of April, 2022, we already had people that had paid for accounts. And so we were able to achieve in just a matter of weeks, something that we expected would take more than a year just to get our foot in the door.
Moving maybe to a little bit about yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background?
Okay, quick story. I was born in the French Caribbean. I'm an engineer by trade, computer science engineer. And when I graduated from one of the most prestigious engineering schools in France, I got the exact job that I wanted as an engineer at the exact salary I wanted in the company that I had been aiming for years. And I got that job. I was there for like 4 weeks when I realized, my God, I am incredibly miserable here. I stand it. And that was tough, because when you get exactly what you wanted and you're miserable, then what can you do? So yeah, I realized that I couldn't do, I couldn't work there. I didn't want to be an employee. I didn't want to have to set an alarm clock every morning to leave before the sun rose and to go to this company to have artificial lighting all day. And so I said, okay, quit. And I'm going to start my own company. And I told, when I called my parents to announce that, that conversation was quite suspenseful, I would say, because I was the first person in my family. Only 4 generations we moved from when France abolished the slave trade. My dad was the first engineer in the entire like family tree. I was the first person to graduate and have these options for a great job. And here I'm saying, I quit. This is like great position. I quit. Start a company. And then when people ask me like, what's the company? My answer was like, I don't know. Give me a year to figure it out. That was 2006. So I made a promise to my parents at the time. I said, well, I'm going to spend a year from September 29th to September 29th. Within a year, I will have started a company that is viable, that is profitable, and that pays me at least as much as my engineer job. Otherwise, I'm just going to go back and beg for my job back. And so I kept the promise. Took almost the whole year, but kept the promise. And I started a company that did, at the time, 3 things. First, I was a salsa dance instructor. So I was teaching classes. I was I won international championships, or placed third. I didn't win. Taught salsa. Second thing, I had a website that had like music that musicians were uploading. So we were monetizing with ads, and I grew that a lot. And third, I was the first dating coach in France. I was giving dating advice to single men, because I used to be a very shy person, and I overcame that and I taught from that experience. And so this third business is what took off like wildfire. I was on TV almost all the time, TV, radio, in all of the French newspapers for several years. They won the major like national TV channel in France, came and did a hidden camera investigation of one of my coaching programs, and it worked. Like, the guy that they were following at the end got the girlfriend. So when that on TV, then the whole business blew up. We kept replaying that like for years, this show. So it kept like bringing more awareness. And what happened is other entrepreneurs said, well, you're teaching something that's quite unusual and it's working. So what if you could teach us your marketing strategies in our businesses? And that's when I started the Free Entrepreneurs Movement. And that's history.
I love the story of you got what you wanted. And it turns out, hey, it's not exactly what, you know, you see yourself doing.
Right, what you imagine. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I did the same similar thing, got the dream job. And it was like, you know, I see these people around me, 65 years old, people are telling them, hey, your life's just beginning. These guys are not in good shape. Their life is definitely not beginning. It's, yeah, must have spent 40 years doing this stuff, right?
there were 2 triggers for me to live there. One was, I realized, well, the reason I got into computers was because it was a way to connect people. So I was building, I loved building like internet tools and apps, even in the early internet, had the web TV, things like that. The job I was doing there, I was working on the purchasing systems for a big railway company. It wasn't what I wanted. And the second one is, I had this colleague there that also wanted to start a business. He was like, just like me, like, maybe I should leave and start a business. And he had that dream. He was in that job for 5 years thinking, well, if I just stay a little bit more, get a bit more of a network, save some money, I'm going to start it. And he, like, I could see myself in the future keeping, like, with the justification of delaying starting the business. And I said, okay, if this guy is the version of me in 5 years, that's still miserable there. I don't want that. So that's why I said I quit today, not in 5 years.
I've read a lot of your Indie Hacker stuff, and it's so awesome to watch you grow and see, look back and just see the numbers that you're crushing. What are you currently doing in revenue?
So we have an interesting curve. So I'm gonna explain two terms so that everybody understands. So monthly recurring revenue in if you have a startup, especially if selling software, that's like the thing that you should watch every day, like milk on fire, as we say in France. And in the first year, we were not, like, as I said, I started with a couple of clients, and then I was still building product. And 3 months later, my ex-business partner from another business said, well, dude, I don't see you doing any marketing. You're just working on the product all the time. So where's your MRR, monthly recurring revenue? I said, it's still the same. So from maybe April to July, it was still the same. And he said, you have to fix this. Nobody cares about the product if nobody can buy it. So I started marketing it, and then we grew slowly. I think over the first year, we grew from zero to about 100 customers. And since our average subscription is 1,000 a year, that took us to 100,000 annual recurring revenue. So if those people don't leave and we don't get anybody else, then the next year we would do 100,000 again. The next year, we grew from 100K annual recurring revenue to 400K annual recurring revenue, meaning we 4X the business. So we were doing just under 40K per month. And then we breached the like 40-ish barrier per month level. So that brought us to 500K in annual recurring revenue. This year has been very challenging and exhilarating, because we've grown much faster than anticipated and had to deal with the fallback from that. So what happened is we launched with a huge partner company, and doing that deal brought a lot of cash into the company. So we went from, we had a month where we did, like, we were doing like 40K a month, and we had a single month where we did 110,000, but a lot of that revenue was not recurring revenue. The goal for the year is to 4X again. So we did 100K to 400K. And now the goal this year is to go from 400K annual to 1.6 million annual.
I think that's a great place to segue to, like, customer acquisition and growth. You mentioned your first 100 customers. What was that like, getting that first 100 customers? Was that like the biggest challenge, or?
Getting the first 100 customers was challenging, it was not challenging for the usual reasons, which is getting customers is hard. That's the usual reason. It was challenging because we had to change our entire playbook. Before OneTech AI, I was selling coaching and information and masterminds, resources. There's a certain way you sell that. And typically, when you sell information, you sell by giving away information. So I've published books, bestsellers. I did a lot of webinars, which were like free content. And then with the free content, people see how impactful this is already, and then they want to buy the framework. It's very rare to be able to successfully do that with software. The only company that's been very successful in that space is ClickFunnels, selling information and packaging the software with it. Everybody else is kind of like dabbling. Either they sell the information and they try to pass the company as a software company, but really people are buying the information, or it just doesn't work. And so at the beginning, what was tough is we tried to use the old formula. We tried to do the webinar, give a lot of information, sell a course, bundle the software. And this was the first time in my entire career that I did a webinar that had hundreds of people on it. And despite getting like the highest rated webinar I've ever done in terms of content and feedback from people, we made zero sales. That was the first webinar. And that was completely depressing, because our typical rates would be, if 100 people attend, we should have 4 sales, 4 to 10 sales of a information product, like $1,000 course. I had to question everything. It took several months to find the formula and to realize, well, for this, for OneTech AI, for what we offer, one-click video editing, what people really need to know is to see is just the before and after. And one of my friends who actually came up with the name One Take, Dylan Frost, he said, dude, what you need is to shoot the shittiest video you can afford to and show that and then put it in the software and then show the result. So every time you add a new feature that fixes a new kind of mistake, you have to create a new demo video that has this problem. And then you show the worst, like the worst before and the best after. And when we started doing that, that's when it really clicked. So our webinars went from 0% conversion to like 2, 3, 4, and now it's 15. So if 100 people attend, 15 people buy an annual subscription before the webinar is over because of that, like the strength of the demo.
So is that kind of your current model? Is that like your, is that still a good strategy that you put in place, webinars and then showing them what's going on with the software?
Yes, that's our best selling strategy.
How do you get people into the webinars? How do you invite people? Do you use social or like what's your best lead?
Three ways. First, I have a list, an email list of people that have subscribed to my newsletter over the years, majority being French speaking, just historically. So I would say maybe 70,000 French speaking entrepreneurs. And then a few, maybe 10,000 plus English speaking, Italian speaking, Japanese, Spanish, Portuguese. And so I send content regularly, I do online challenges, and I invite those people to the live sessions and the webinars. So that was the first way we got the company, like we started it, like we bootstrapped it. Second, I reached out to people from my network and people from like their network to be affiliates. They had an audience and to promote the webinar either by inviting me to speak to their audience, and so they would be on the call, or by just inviting their audience to come over to my webinar. And I would pay a commission. I pay a lifetime commission to those affiliates. So they get a commission on every recurring payment ever that those people generate. So that's, I think now it's a bit over a third of our sales come from that. Just from people inviting me to speak to their audience on like Facebook lives, webinars, things like that. And then the third part is advertising. That was so hard. I didn't expect this to be that hard because I've done Google Ads since 2007, Facebook Ads since 2009. And usually there's a formula that works, but inviting people from there to the webinar to do the demo of the software, it took a year and a half for us to figure out the formula for that. So we just about figured that out.
And that you do a lot of other socials or just mainly, so the advertising and then the web?
The advertising. So we right now we expect that to be a big component of our growth this year. Paradoxically, okay, we have this expression in French. I don't know if you have this similar in English where we say like the shoemakers have the worst shoes. If you looked at our social media presence, you would even maybe not find it at the time that we're talking today because like a video company, but me being both the face and the CEO, the face of the company and the CEO and the product person and many other roles in the company, I just don't have as much time to create all of the video content I used to do. Specifically, when I was doing the online training company, I was publishing 140 pieces of content per day at some point during COVID. And now that I have the video editing company, I actually haven't published a video at all in the whole last week, for instance. So one of our big plans this year is to like restart the production of this content because we use our software to sell, but we don't use it to create free content, not at the moment. So it's just a matter of having the time and the space to do that when we have other ways to sell already.
One of the lessons I'd like to hit with on like customer acquisition and growth is churn, right? Everybody's, you got to worry about churn. What do you guys do to kind of slow churn down and keep on it?
That was a really expensive lesson learned from a previous startup I had 10 years ago. That startup lost 30% of customers every month. And so it was just not viable. But it's fairly typical, like for new subscription products, you have like 3 to 5 months lifetime value. And I learned from Sue McLaren that you should shoot for something like 27 months or more like that. You should be very ambitious there. So from the beginning, when I started One Take, we decided to focus on that. Like, how can we keep people engaged, keep them longer? So when we started out of the gate, our retention was about a year, and then it grew to over 2 years average. And some of the things that we do to increase that retention, we have live sessions with customers twice a month. There's one, like, in a couple of days, I spend 2 hours showing what's new in the software, answering questions, talking about the roadmap, answering questions about the roadmap, taking customer requests, things that people would like to be in the software. So we do that, like, a lot of this presence, creating training content for the customers. So we don't sell courses to the outside world anymore. That's not our business model. But we do create courses, and we have, like, experts teaching their paid course to our customers for free. So that's also being a big factor of retention, because when people are more successful, they stay. And the third thing is a hack. It's really like it's a complete growth hack that happened almost by accident. Is when we started the software, my first offer for it was the business plan. And the business plan is limited to 30 video projects. Like, you could create 30 courses with it and host them at a time. But if you wanted to create a new course, you would need to delete one of the existing ones. And what happened is, when we got ready to launch that, our developer at the time had not coded the limitation yet. And we had the choice between spend a week coding the limits or spend a week adding new useful features. And I kept selecting new features, more useful features. Let's make the software more useful, not like more limited. Making it more limited is better for us in a way, but making it more useful is better for the customer. So when I made the offer for the first time, I was like, okay, well, it's limited to 30. It says that when you log in. But if you upload project number 31, it's going to work, because we didn't have the limit there yet. So what I decided to do is, I said, well, you should buy now. And you actually use the software right away. Like, you create a video, whatever video, but you just create one now. Then we will make your account unlimited. Now, because we did that, what happened is, this is a metric most people probably don't know, but the vast majority of people that sign up for software don't use it, like, ever. So if you get 30% of the people that signed up to actually use it, you're good. If you get 50%, you're great. And we were getting 75% of people that signed up to use it, like, same day, let's go, let's put something online because I want to secure my unlimited spot. And so that works wonders for retention, because once people have used it once, they know how it works. And there are only two outcomes if they tried the same day. The first outcome is it works exactly like they wanted. And as a result, they are now, like, more confident to use it in the future. The second outcome is maybe something isn't like they wanted. Like, maybe I'll take an example from our software. Maybe they do it, they watch the video, and then they're like, huh, no, I didn't want it to be a horizontal video. I wanted it to be vertical. And what happens is the software is totally able to do that, but maybe they didn't see how to do this. So because they took action on the day of the purchase, they are still, like, in the energy and the motivation of it. So they will actually write to support and say, hey guys, I tried to do a vertical video, but I got a horizontal one. What can I do? And then support will say, well, just click this button. And if you always want vertical, just check the box that says always do this. And because we solved the problem, now they've had the positive support experience, they've gotten the result, and now they're more confident to use it in the future. So this is, like, I think this one thing has been the biggest level for retention for all of those initial users. So now we do have the limits coded into the software now, like 2 years later. At some point we did spend the time to do that, but we try to always have an incentive for people to activate and use it. And the incentive itself is usually worth hundreds or thousands of dollars, just so that they get to doing it.
So I think moving into the kind of toward the end of our conversation, maybe diving into some personal insights from you. So the internet and life these days is just an attention trap. What do you do as a founder to stay focused and motivated on a day-to-day basis?
So my approach is a bit different from most people. It's probably not for everyone, but if there are other people out there that closet introverts, meaning you're able to, like, I'm speaking for the company today, right? I speak on stages, I do the videos, I don't mind doing that. However, that's not my, like, favorite mode of expression. I would be very happy if the internet left me alone, right? And I just work on my books, on my software, on my own. But I have this mission, so I'm there for it. So if there are other people like me that are listening I think one superpower is to allow the internet and the world at large to be a medium instead of a push medium, meaning you go get what you need from this pool of information, but you don't allow it to push information onto you. So I do not have notifications of any kind enabled on my phone. I have an assistant that reads my personal emails and set up the call with you today. Like, she knows what's important, what's going to be useful for the company. She knows how to make things happen. Brilliant people doing customer service. And I'm available on the live sessions with customers, so like on the Zoom, but I don't like, I'm not like scrolling the 15,000 tickets manually every day, so that I can create. And this, I think, is very important. Same for social media, things like this. I keep updated on AI. I read every day all the new papers, product announcements that are in the field, because this is literally my job. But I don't consume any other form of social media. I don't let it push information onto me. I go get this information.
How did you come to realize that's what you needed to do? Did you just, is that just something that came naturally to you? You just said, hey, this is time consuming and just taking too much time out of me, or you just have your eye on more important things?
Well, you have to look back at what happens if you're starting. Like, I was a dating coach for guys, like the first one in 2007. And when you start getting on television and having all of this content online, what happens is you get tens of thousands of emails. And those emails range from, oh my God, you've changed my life, to people inviting you to their wedding because they met your wife with your advice, to random people. Like, there are also people like asking what's the cost of the product, is it like commercial interest? But you also get like random people sending you really weird things, or saying, oh my God, you are everything that's wrong in the world is you, or whatever. So I realized at some point, okay, there was a day where, this is not an exaggeration, we had sent an email to my newsletter asking people to give feedback on what the books and the DVDs were doing for them. And that day I read 100 testimonials of people that said, this is amazing, it's changing my life. And I read one comment of one random dude that was not a customer that said, well, screw you, you must be an awful person, whatever. Like, somebody that didn't even consume the content. And I realized this one comment was dragging me down so much that the 100 positive testimonials I've just read the same day are not like compensating, because there's a huge leverage in the negativity. Mm. And I said, okay, that's it. And so I've been email free since 2008, actually, because of that like aha moment of pain and realizing, well, if we want to be able to contribute, we have to guard the door of our minds. Stand guard at the door of our minds, if I remember the quote correctly.
Something I love to ask people, every entrepreneur that I meet, is, what was your childhood like? Did you always know that you were going to be you didn't know you wanted to be an entrepreneur all the time. You found that the hard way, right? What was your childhood like, though, growing up?
So when I was a kid, what I knew I wanted to be a mad scientist. Like, not just a scientist, I wanted to be a mad scientist for some reason. But I was very lucky in that. So my parents, who are still together and have been married for now 43 years, they instilled a sense in me and my siblings that we could achieve anything that we really put our effort into. And so they were always very encouraging when we had ideas, crazy things that we wanted to experiment with or do. And they really cultivated this sense of imagination and not being stuck. Because my dad has always been very proud of, like, not just what he's achieved, but what he, as the elder of 8 siblings, has helped him achieve. And he wanted the same for his kids. So by the time I left home to go abroad, to go to mainland France, I left the French Caribbean when I was 16, I was determined to do something great. I just didn't know what it would be, but I knew I could do something great. I just had to figure it out. And yeah, that's been a very helpful like foundation. And when I look at the career that my sisters have had, for instance, they're both very accomplished businesswomen, and it's also stemmed from that same belief. So I have a daughter, and I try to cultivate this same sense, not the sense of entitlement, like everything you do is going to succeed or success like has to come to you, but a sense of possibility. If you feel like today we should go and, I don't know, race with people in the mud or whatever, and you have this idea, let's make it an event, let's do it then. Let's see what happens, right? Instead of being a default no or taking people down.
So wrapping up here, what would your advice be to somebody who wants to looking to start their own SaaS company?
Specifically a SaaS company?
Yeah.
Okay. I would say there is the advice that I received myself. So build the MVP instead of trying to like grow this monster over years. Like figure out what you can achieve in like 2 to 4 weeks that can solve the problem for somebody that has so much pain that they're willing to use this broken, halfway done tool to, they're willing to pay for it because the problem is so high. And I think this by itself is such a big filter, because then you're able to help people that would not even be getting anything done without this tool. In our case, when we started One Take AI, and up till now, most of our users that use our software to edit their videos into professional presentations, they are not like YouTubers and TikTokers and Instagrammers. They're not people that do this professional video for a living. They are people that with One Take would just not be able to get that done at all, or would have to spend thousands of dollars on freelancers to get it done. So the last part of my advice is, if you do this, if you focused on who's willing to pay, because the problem is so big for them, that they're willing to pay for the MVP that until it gets better, it means that you get your mind to build something that addresses people that are currently not addressed in the market. And when we started One Take, we had this blue ocean of this, the only tool where instead of looking like a NASA cockpit where there's 1,000 buttons and this huge timeline and 2 million options, there's like one button. You put your video in there, you click the magic button, you're done for the day, the video is edited for you. That was a huge vision. And I still have somewhere saved the Google search results. I screenshot it for a video editor, and there was like no results before we got started with One Take. And now if you Google that, there's like a bazillion results, like everybody's an AI video editor. But getting started, I think this vision is important.
I appreciate you meeting with me. In conclusion, is there anything else you'd like to share with the readers, the watchers?
Yeah, two things. The first one is, I'm not going to tell you to buy One Take AI. I'm just going to tell you that you can try it for free. There is actually a page like try.onetake.ai. You can just record yourself or upload the video and you can see it by yourself. And second, we create a lot of resources for everybody that's in. So even if you try the software and you don't purchase it yet, then we do send a lot of valuable resources, even though we don't post them on social media. And I know I got to get on that. So yeah, my call to action would be to just go give it a try on